Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. I'm your host, Adam Horner. With 30 years in the industry, including over a decade as a CTO, I have coached and mentored more than 100 engineers and tech leaders. This podcast covers crucial topics for CTOs, providing insights, strategies, and practical advice to help you build and refine your own playbook. In today's episode, I have Zach Goldberg with me, author of the Startup CTO's Handbook and a seasoned CTO who has led engineering teams across multiple startups and growth stages. We discuss some of the essential leadership lessons he's learned from years of building and managing high-performing teams. We'll hear about Zach's journey from engineer to CTO and the universal truths he's discovered about managing and coaching engineering managers. He shares invaluable advice on creating a culture of continuous learning, setting a high bar for coaching, and fostering an external-facing culture of thought leadership. Zach also highlights the key challenges CTOs face as they scale their companies and how to avoid common mistakes. By the end of this episode, you'll be left with a clear playbook for coaching your engineering leaders and the confidence to apply it with your own leadership team. Zach has so many actionable insights to share. If you find today's episode valuable, please visit our website to join the CTO Playbook community and access more resources and support for your CTO journey. The community link and the link to Zach's book are in the show notes. Zach, so great you could join me. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Adam. It's an absolute pleasure.
It's wonderful to be able to talk to you. I've read the book that you put together. But for those people who don't know that much about you, it'd be great to learn a little bit about your background, you know, how you got into being a CTO and your journey.
Yeah, no, thanks for the opportunity. The book Adam's mentioning, of course, is the book I wrote a couple years ago called The Startup CTO's Handbook. The backstory there, and I think sort of maybe perhaps working backwards, as the book came out of, I was working with a somewhat larger team, or at least for me, it's a mid-sized company, the engineering team, 50, 60 people. And had just this really wonderful team of managers I was working with. And, you know, no company is perfect and no team is perfect, but it did feel like we were really making good progress. Morale was really good. Velocity, we were all really happy with. The product was working. And was just learning so many great tips. And, you know, over my career, being an engineer and engineering manager and then working at this company, it just felt there was so many things we had learned that seemed to be a pattern. Things that I had seen in prior jobs, the managers I had worked with had seen in prior circumstances. And there's just a large array of universal truths to engineering management that seem to apply regardless of what company you're at. Of course, every company is different and the nuances are different. The requirements are different. Everybody's got different headaches. But underlying it all, there are some things about how you build an engineering team to set them up for high velocity and high impact that seem to be universal. And so the book was my effort to sort of distill those things outside of the raw technology. Right? So it's not a book on technical architecture, distributed systems. It's a book about managing people, putting together teams in resource-constrained environments like startups, and how to do that successfully. And so my credentials leading up to that was I started my career as an engineer. I have a degree in engineering, really still love writing software even to this day. I think it's really important for managers to stay very close to the fun, geeky side of it and really be hands-on keyboard from time to time. And just over my career transitioned, did a little bit of product management, but really the past decade and change has been engineering leadership at small companies. And so I've been a CTO at, I think, 6 different startups. One or two of those I started myself. So I've been the co-founder as well as the hired leader. And just really, I found that's what I enjoy the most, right? It's taking an idea that's like the business vision and taking resources, time, and people and making that into reality. And that's that driving that impact has been very a fun career, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. And really honored that it's led me here to chatting with you today, Adam.
I was going to say, because it must have driven some absolutely fantastic experiences if you want to dive back into being a startup founder again. There's a number of people I know who've gone through that process and thinking, never again.
There is a certain level of, which is the phrase, is it masochism? I think it's masochism, the one where you inflict pain upon yourself. But there's just no faster way to grow and learn than through those struggles. And every time is different. You know, the product's different, the market's different, customers are different. And that's every day is therefore different. And that's exciting. And I've always enjoyed that and really valued that in my career.
And so have you found yourself sort of sticking to those distillations that you got from that first experience and got into the book when you've gone through and done your other startups and your other companies as well? Then
I think there's some things that absolutely translate regardless of where you are. And I try very hard to not make those same mistakes twice. I try and remember, I think it was This is a quote in the book as well. It's not my quote. I'm quoting somebody else. Bismarck, I think. Was it, fools learn from the, fools learn from their mistakes. I prefer to learn from the mistakes of others. Right. And so I've learned a lot of those mistakes and actually took the following step and wrote down what felt like good answers to those mistakes and trying to now put those into practice on a regular basis. You know, things in hiring, things in working with other managers, setting up tech culture, process standards. And trying to empower the smart people that are around me to do their best work.
Yeah, because I think one of the things that that you've done in particular that I really liked coming out of the book is not just how you lead engineers, but also how you lead engineering leaders. And is that something that you sort of built up as a firsthand experience? Is that something that you picked up from others that you've worked with? I mean, where did the best sort of practices for that come from?
Yeah, I think the most poignant sort of lessons I learned, let's say, is, I mean, every manager who's sort of grown with a company realizes pretty quickly or is taught at some point, there's just a limit to how many people you can directly manage, right? Depending on the manager, somewhere between 4 and 10, maybe 5 or 6 is sort of that sweet spot where after that, your brain just doesn't have enough space to work with everybody in the way that they deserve to be worked with.
You can't do each person justice.
Yes, exactly. And to do the work justice and keep everybody happy and keep those relationships strong and the knowledge transfer and all these things. And so inevitably, you're growing, you're going to be working with other engineering managers or tech leads, whatever your business calls them. And now all of a sudden, the day-to-day work is not, you know, directly influenced by you, right? There's another person who's responsible for interfacing with the people writing the software. And so they're the ones actually driving the quality, driving the velocity, driving the expectations on, you know, testing and customer interaction and, you know, debugging and debt management and all these kinds of things. And so very quickly, your impact becomes proxied through them. And so it seems pretty obvious then that you want to make sure that proxy is a really high quality and that, you know, they're of course going to do some things differently from you because they're different and they have a slightly different style, but there's bedrock foundations you need to make sure are present. And my experience comes from at the time, I was managing 3 different managers who were, could not have been more different people. And, you know, to protect the innocent, I had the expert manager who was a better manager than I was. I didn't have to teach this person anything about management. I had a tech lead who was incredibly strong in engineering, and competent as a manager, but they really loved engineering. Management was not their future. They were just in that position. And then the third one was the problem. Less experience as a manager, not adopting best practices as an IC. And so I sort of had the whole spectrum and learning different lessons from the 3 of them. Go ahead.
That was your first experience with them, pretty much, of leading leaders.
No, that was probably my 2nd or 3rd, but that was the most, it was the most poignant.
I can imagine with the spectrum of experiences like that. And
yeah. And it was through an acquisition. And so, you know, the 2 managers that I, you know, I'm biased, but that I thought were awesome for different reasons, or came from my side of the business, and the other was the other company that we merged with. But you know, everybody, of course, has their merits and skills, but there was different quantities and severity of areas for improvement that needed to be worked on. And the just, you know, working with the other manager who I'm unashamed in saying this person just has incredible EQ, really good eye for culture. Like he and I had this really great collaboration where we would see the same problems, right? Okay, this over the manager over here, he's allowing this type of debt to propagate and he's not taking proactive steps to pay down that debt to avoid the pain in the future. And in fact, doesn't even realize that it's happening. All right, how do we have that conversation? What does that mean in terms of our internal documentation and culture around paying down debt or release processes or, you know, whatever the nuance was? And that sort of loop you can imagine where we'd identify these sorts of issues, think through what's the best practice here? How does this apply? What's our experience? Is a lot of the stuff that ended up making it into the book.
Cool. And so when you had that experience and you were going through and setting up basically the standards and the ways of working, how did you sort of define that culture of what you wanted? Was it set with you and this other more awesome engineering leader who you'd already had this good relationship with? Was there some other elements that came into it? What was sort of the bit that allowed you to set the benchmark in a good way for what the culture should be?
Yeah. So at this particular company, it was a relatively low margin SaaS business. Right. And so, you know, we had to be very, very careful with how we allocated capital, which meant we were not paying top salaries. And so at the end of the day, people, you know, in a competitive marketplace, employees choose jobs either because the compensation package is incredible, because it's some sort of mission that they're really driven towards, or there's some sort of culture or something about the day to day they really love. And at this particular company, we tried really, really hard to lean into that last one. where we wanted to be a great place to work, an engineering environment where you would learn a lot, you would deliver a lot, you enjoyed your coworkers, process was strong, the tools were, if not perfect, they were at least trending in the right direction, and where you could do software engineering and have fun with it, right? So we that was really important for our ability to hire and retain talent. And so that was sort of the North Star on our culture and enabled us to actually spend more time than I might otherwise have. I mean, culture is always incredibly important, if not the most important thing. But even above and beyond that, we were using it as a cornerstone of sort of our retention and hiring strategy.
So you're actually attracting people in with your culture. Yeah, right.
In addition to using it as a cornerstone of delivering velocity and keeping morale high and things like this. And so it was, you know, that framework, if you will, drove a lot of the decision-making and thinking about, you know, how do we set up the various process or think about culture and so on and so forth.
Yeah, because I find that a lot of the time, culture is driven by behaviors and behaviors are often driven by processes. And so therefore, getting those right and getting the goal of the processes right is often a fairly big indicator of where your culture is going to end up when it, once everything's sort of worked through and learned.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's a reflection, I think, of the priorities of leadership. Right? It, you know, some businesses are very much in a risk-averse mode. And so the priority is don't mess up the business. Like, don't get hacked. Don't have the system go down. Right? Don't have anything that shows up badly in the New York Times. And so your process and your decision-making becomes very risk-averse. Right? And that tends to be more red tape, more paperwork, things move slower. And you have other businesses where, you know, innovation at all costs. And, you know, that obviously drives a very different set of processes.
And in that second environment, what you often end up with is, in order to generate the innovation, you also need to have quite a high bar of what people are doing and attempting. And so therefore, people need to learn quite a lot. So how do you go through and set up a culture of learning? What are the sort of the cornerstones you put in place to make learning something that's happening, you know, all the time?
Yeah, I think there's two elements to it. One is sort of, or maybe three elements as I think about it out loud. One is acknowledging and allowing failure, right? When you learn things, that's, you know, your best learning comes from your mistakes. And so that has to be okay, right? You have to allow people to experiment and not punish failure and in fact, reward and encourage that sort of experimentation, which is often going to not work out.
Right. So an environment of sort of psychological safety to allow that to happen. Yeah.
That's a great phrase. Then there's explicitly setting up and carving out time and resources for proactive learning, right? So not just learning from my mistakes, but I'm also, there's a book club, there's, we all attend seminars, there's a budget to go to conferences, you know, whatever things in that box.
Internal talks and those kinds of things, yeah.
Exactly. And sort of, you know, and that's above and beyond, like, how does this particular system that I'm an expert at work, but hey, there's a new thing in the next version of Next.js, and that's kind of cool. We may or may not use it, but I'd want to, you know, share about why I think it's interesting, right? So there's internal intellectual, keeping the intellectual edge moving forwards. And then the third piece is, as a manager of managers, you need to make sure that you're not just opening the door for these things, but your managers and your business as a whole, as a policy, is keeping the door open for learning. So it's not just that my team is reading books and doing a book club and going to conferences. It's that the managers that I work with have all had that same set of instructions and operate the same way. So they're working with their ICs and, you know, however many other layers of management. So throughout the entire organization, everybody is empowered to spend time, resources, and actually keep that, you know, keep their brain moving forwards.
So not just empowered, but also the propagation needs to be reinforced and encouraged then, which is one of those areas I find where an inexperienced CTO can end up sort of keep pushing it one layer, but doesn't necessarily get it to go all the way down to the IC level. And so therefore kind of only half implement the environment. Have you seen that?
Absolutely. I think it's a common pattern in general as you scale. And it's not just about learning. It's also about pretty much everything you communicate, your culture, your strategy. Anytime there's something new that everybody needs to know about, the number of times you have to say things, it's probably a factor, an order of magnitude more than your intuition has it. And it's not just saying it out loud in meetings. It's also making sure it's written in the right place in the documentation. It's in the onboarding guide. The HR department knows about it. Your managers know about it. Your leadership team, you know, just, you know, the number of avenues that's this one-to-many communication is underestimated and very easy to get wrong. And the consequences are, as you say, either, you know, the learning doesn't get propagated or the people don't feel empowered or they feel left out worse and, you know, all the bad things that come from that.
Yeah, ouch. I've often heard it described as just to the point when you're beginning to get sick of saying it and repeating it, people are beginning to hear it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you're about halfway done at that point.
Good stuff. So, I mean, in terms of that, and you know, when you're coaching the leaders, the engineering leaders, you're sort of setting a high bar for how you're coaching and then how they are coaching their team members and so on. How do you sort of measure that bit? How do you sort of get a benchmark for where it's at and how much extra effort and time you need to put in there? Because it's one of those things I find that people don't really know when they've done enough, and on the flip side of it, don't really know when to stop, when they've actually got to the point where it is working like that the way they want to.
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't have a single canned answer. I can think of two kinds of answers, maybe. You know, the first is, and this is a bit of a cop out. A lot of things in culture, you sort of know when it's working. You just feel it, right? People are talking about it. You get it's an intuition, plus you're getting little bits of signal from lots of places that feed in perhaps subconsciously to what we feel like is intuition. But I think the real answer is part of good management culture is making sure that there's robust feedback loops. And so if you're specifically looking for signal on, is the learning working, that should be built into those feedback loops. And that's a number of different, there's many implementations of that. Pulse surveys, engagement surveys, regular reviews, 360 reviews, performance reviews, you know, all these things are taking place at various cadences and are opportunities to be asking questions and getting signal on, do people feel empowered to spend time and resources furthering their own education?
Right. So part of it is quite literally asking, and the other part of it is making sure that the questions are in all those areas where you'd be gathering your sort of ongoing incoming data from the team, from the wider team.
Exactly. Yeah. And I missed one-on-one meetings. Like, another one of those things kind of always keeps saying.
Yeah, one-on-ones are so important, aren't they? So, I mean, maybe that's worth touching on briefly because, you know, we're talking about leaders. I mean, often we end up with the main interaction with our engineering managers as being through one-to-ones. It's sort of one of the most important mechanisms. And I think when I see early stage CTOs where they've just got, individual contributors reporting directly to them, one-to-ones can be overlooked. You can get away with it. But I think once you get to the level of engineering managers, it becomes even more essential. Would you agree with that general sentiment there?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think remote versus in-person has influence here. And you need to index a little bit more on the structured meetings with remote environments just to like force that communication bandwidth. But either way, I agree with you. There is a threshold at which, you know, you're not in stand-ups with every team anymore. Right. And you're not in a review meeting or, you know, a planning meeting with all the people that you need to talk to on a regular basis, or you need to make sure you've got that communication door lines open. And yes. And then I think it's really funny. I was taught the idea of a skip level pretty much in my very first job in 2010. And it was just sort of like part of early training. And I had a skip level with somebody two levels above me at the organization. And that was like basically my very first real professional experience. It wasn't a big deal. It was just like a thing that was mentioned. And it's now 2024, you know, some odd 15 years later. And I'm seeing articles like, did you know that skip levels are a thing? And I talked to my wife and she's like, we don't do skip levels at her organization that's 10 times the size of mine. And I'm just like, how is this? This feels like if it was taught to me on day one, it's probably taught to a lot of other people on day one. And probably it was taught in business school, which I went to engineering school. So I'm assuming that that's in there. And yet still, we have large, sophisticated organizations that don't do some of these best practices, such that there's blog articles written. Like, I just discovered this thing halfway through my career.
I think you probably had a relatively unique experience there, because I have to say a lot of the people that I speak to, where they've come out of, you know, really top engineering schools in the UK and Europe, or whether they've come out of, you know, business schools, actually, it's not something that I think there's ever normally covered. So I think you had a, I don't know whether to call it lucky or unique experience. But so I think it certainly set you off on a good start there. And I think it's something that all of us can actually learn from, because having a regular one-to-one with somebody who's two or even more levels down to the organization, if you've got a big enough organization to be that deep, it can really tell you what's going on, you know, the ground truth in a way that is very difficult to get if all you speak to is the people who directly report to you.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many positive, so many failure modes that it avoids, right? You know, depending on, you know, how much you trust your managers, right? And learning and perhaps gaining that trust by doing the skip levels. You know, the worst case scenario is you have some particular manager who's got disgruntled ICs, and that manager, for whatever reason, ego, pride, whatever, doesn't communicate up the problems to the, you know, that they're seeing to the organization because they're, for whatever reason, then you as the two level manager, you just don't lose all that data, right? And now not only are you not getting the data, you have a manager who's enforcing this culture of lack of transparency. All of these things can be identified and remediated with a periodic skip level. And yeah, I that's a good point. I have not a thing I've surveyed, but this is exactly why I wrote the book, right? Because there's these, like, it's not a complicated concept, right? Like, you can explain it in a paragraph. Like, everybody, when they start the career, should read that paragraph and just have that background knowledge.
Excellent. I mean, I'm talking of which, you also mentioned training materials as, you know, as one of those things that's really essential. So, I mean, obviously, we can get people to go on courses and so on. But I mean, there's your book and then there's several other sort of key background readings. You have like a sort of a fixed bookshelf of things that you get people to look at and read that you make available to everybody in your engineering organizations? Or is it something you build dynamically for each organization?
Yeah, that's a great question. And thus far in my career, I have built it for each organization, you know, a list of somewhere between 2 and 5 books that we don't force people to read. Every, you know, people consume content differently, but we strongly encourage. There's some that show up more often than others. Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink and Leif Babbitt is just almost always at the top there. It's just like reinforcing what good communication looks like, what taking ownership looks like the importance of, you know, commander's intent, things like this. It's just transformative for culture and setting the expectation with everybody who joins the organization. But beyond that, you know, going forwards, I'll probably recommend my own book, although I'm not sure how to do that without it coming across as, you know, socially awkward and perhaps a bit arrogant.
I think it's always expected when you've written a book that other people, you'd expect other people to read it at this stage.
It's thus far how it has worked out, and this is just an amusing anecdote, is the CEOs I've worked with have bought, you know, a dozen or whatever and shipped them out to people. And so it's come from them as opposed to coming from me. I didn't ask for that. It's just they did that of their own volition, which is because they're kind. And that's been less awkward.
Yeah. No, but that's good. I think having a physical printed copy of it is well worthwhile, because I ended up you know, basically using the quick link you got on your website to go to the GitHub version of it. And then I have it as an open reference on my desktop pretty much all the time, to be honest, especially when I'm coaching. But I find it very, very useful when I'm coaching to give, you know, immediate and quick reference context to people who I'm talking to, because often I'm talking to CTOs who are first time or second time in the role. And as you know, there's just a bunch of things that they don't know at that stage. And so having a sort of a framework of reference is very useful. So that's the main reason I use the digital version of it. But that's interesting that you basically put together a culture every time that you sort of you know, set up the sort of books. Yeah, Extreme Ownership is a great book. I've read it once. I have my own favorite go-to book as well, which is Turn the Ship Around, David L. Marquette, which is sort of very similar kind of idea, but just approached in a different way.
Yeah, the Navy versus the Marines, right?
Yeah, I mean, who'd have guessed that the sort of 19th century military command and control folks still have so much to tell us about leadership and ownership so many years on.
I think to your point, it's what I found is, I can't tell you how many business books I've been through at this point. There's a lot of common threads. But what sticks, of course, is the stories. And who has better stories than the guy who's on, you know, the disgruntled, ineffective submarine, and he's got to change the culture of, you know, 100 plus people trapped underwater in months at a time. Like, that generates the most compelling, interesting stories versus, you know, the guy in Santa Clara who's, you know, going into an office every day. It's a little bit less life or death there.
Yeah, more takeaway coffee and less torpedoes coming at you on a regular basis.
There's, I've never... you know, I've not been in the armed forces, but I can imagine there is just something very poignant about our, you know, our management has to work in those scenarios.
Yeah, and trust is such an important factor. I mean, I have worked with the British armed forces, and it's one of those areas where there's something about businesses where you often say, don't treat it like a family, because you don't treat employees and teams like a family. You treat it more like a sports team. But in the military, there really is this trust level, which does get to the point where people call each other brother. You know, it's very... very close from that perspective. But talking about sort of a slightly wider organization, a commercial organization, one of the things you also talk about there is developing a culture of external thought leadership as well. So how does that play into sort of the priorities for you in terms of how you're developing your leaders?
Yeah, I think it's part of being a good leader is learning things, but then being able to teach and coach, right? And so that shows up obviously every day in things like one-on-ones, you know, hiring processes, but really strong intellectual writing is just a skill that everybody needs to keep working on that is very powerful within the organizations. And so part of this sort of external leadership has, you know, there's the sort of obvious benefits, right? It looks good for recruiting. It's just good PR and branding, depending on your business. It's, you know, good lead generation, things like this, SEO, so on and so forth. But that's the external benefits. The internal benefits is really the discipline and the skill building of doing that. Of capturing, hey, we're actually doing this sort of interesting thing here. It's somewhat novel, or we're applying a technique in an interesting way, taking a few minutes to figure out how do I distill that into its actual interesting components and then write that in a way that somebody else could understand. Like those muscles are very, very powerful, and it's, you know, very strong ROI to do that internally. It is acknowledged, though, not fast. You know, it takes me at least half a day, sometimes a whole day, to write a blog post. That's a day I'm not spent doing something else. And so, you know, weaving that in, you know, bits at a time into a calendar and a schedule at scale in an organization, it's, you know, there's some cost there. But the benefit, of course, is, you know, the stronger muscles, and that pays off.
Yeah, I think especially when it comes to, for example, communicating a strategy, I think it's one of those areas where if you can distill your thinking down into a great piece of writing or good presentation, then that's, you know, immensely valuable. And of course, if you can do that externally where it's tested by, you know, public opinion on the likes of Twitter, LinkedIn, and so on, where public opinion can be quite vocal at times and quite scathing if you're not clear and not don't say what you mean. It definitely sharpens up your process of doing that right.
Yeah, I mean the consequences of getting it wrong on social media is you get some comments you don't like, right? But that same mistake, which if you're making those clarity mistakes in your public writing, you're almost certainly making those clarity mistakes in your internal writing. Right. And now the consequences are, well, you've onboarded somebody and they misunderstand how a system works. And now they're going to spend time doing things suboptimally, or they're going to get frustrated, and, you know, you're creating inefficiencies in your organization. And so I might argue that perhaps the good writing internally is where really the massive ROI is, and where the failure modes of lack of clarity are costly at scale in a business.
Definitely. And I think it's one of those ones where it can be such a small thing that you can get wrong. Just one or two words can almost change the interpretation of something that you've laid down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you got experiences of that yourself?
One or two words?
Or maybe not so small, but certainly with getting your writing to the point where it's not clear enough, not understood the same way that you meant it.
I think the biggest thing, you know, an example that comes to mind is we had an engineer who built a product internally, sort of a tool. And the tool has, like, there's three different personas. There's the person writing the software, and then there's the two personas. It's called a patch generation tool. So there's the person writing the patches and the person consuming the patches. So three different people in sort of this life cycle. And the engineer wrote the documentation really only from the engineer's perspective and didn't really even draw the picture of, well, there's these other two personas that think about the world slightly differently and use the tool in a different way. And so, at, you know, a very easy and understandable mistake to make. But this idea of I'm writing documentation and putting my head into who are the different consumers of this documentation and what do they care about? What questions are in their mind when they come to these docs? And then structuring and outlining to make it accessible to those different contexts is a skill. It is not a talent. It's not something you're necessarily born with. It is something that you develop through practice and get feedback on and get better at over time. I've worked with engineers who are absolutely convinced that they can't write. They come to me like, I'm just not good at documentation. I said, well, maybe right now you don't think you're good at documentation, but let's get some practice in. And you'd be, you know, trajectories are generally very strong.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things, if you can get engineers to write documentation from the customer's perspective, that empathy starts to build up relatively quickly, because in that way, you end up with other people like your support team, customer success team, coming, you know, looking at it from the customer's perspective, reading what you've written, and then asking some fairly hard pointed questions. But it's not such that it's actually got yet into customers' hands, or sometimes it has, and that's why it's come back to you. But it's a good crucible, I think, for being able to write clearly, is to understand who are you writing for and what do they care about?
We've all had that experience of using somebody else's software for the first time and being frustrated, right? Maybe it's somebody else's project at work, or maybe it's just the most recent app that you downloaded. And there's just this, and this is universal. I don't think I've ever met anybody that doesn't share this experience. This like, how did they miss this obvious thing? It's just so wrong and dumb. And you're just all the negative expletives, right? But then you're, you know, conversely, you're writing the software, building the application, and somebody else is coming at you with those expletives. And it's just this thing your brain does when you're the consumer versus when you are in the nuts and bolts trying to actually build the thing, that the consumer sees so many things that the builder doesn't. And so, like, the importance of being the consumer, I'd say the quality of the engineering teams I've been on are pretty directly correlated to either how easy it was for them to be a consumer of their own work, or how much the business encouraged them to be a consumer of their own work. And the difference between, you know, being a software engineer at Uber, where you take Ubers every day, versus being a software engineer on some enterprise tax software, where, yeah, how do you empathize with building an enterprise P&L if you don't have a giant enterprise to the P&L kind of thing. But finding a way to build that empathy and be that user is very important. I agree.
Yeah. And as you say, being able to get that to the point where your leaders can also do the same thing for thought leadership, for writing, for getting the information out there, absolutely critical.
Yeah. We, a quick war story there. We had, we were building enterprise software. It was in the compliance space. And you can imagine the details matter, right? And how many checkboxes and what the numbers are and the formulas that sanity check the numbers, all these things. And as a software engineer on that team, you would never use the software. there's no occasion for 99% of our staff to use the software. And then to get into the software required, you know, a special license that was government regulated. So it had to have a special number. And then there's like inventory to be managed and dollars to be moved around. And so just simulating those things with fake data also didn't really build empathy. And so we put a bunch of time and effort into building a video course that gave people fake money, like a fake starting balance. And then they would transact and they were given, you know, like external events would be made up, but given to them as if they were real. And then you'd have to go into the system and do things. And so you sort of had the sense of ownership because it was your fake money. And then you had the data you needed to, you know, I don't actually have these things happening in the world, but you've got the key cards. And that was very productive. Expensive to build. Yes. Forced empathy. It was very expensive to build. We didn't ultimately take it all the way. But even just doing the intro courses, the first week or two was very eye-opening. And the feedback was exceptional about how that helped people in onboarding.
That must have taken quite a while to put together because it sounds very non-trivial to get to the point where you've got something that can simulate all of those requirements.
We did have a dedicated learning person. We had a learning staff member, like sort of the learning team. And this was their thing for a solid quarter, if not two. And that produced, I think, 2 weeks of onboarding material, or is a program that you'd go through during your first 2 weeks of onboarding. And so expensive, but you know, at scale, very impactful.
Wow, cool. So one of the things I wanted to do then is just quickly summarize the bits that we've spoken about, because we're really focused today on talking about the leader of leaders role in a growing war, startup organization that's hopefully growing. So we went through there, the continuous learning aspect. We covered having a high bar for the coaching and the management of people. We spoke about having a really good access to learning materials. And hopefully one of those would be the Startup CTO's Handbook. And then we spoke about having this external facing culture of thought leadership. And you mentioned writing as being a key component of that as well. Is there anything else that you would say is sort of one of the sort of single most important tips that you would give to a CTO as they're coming into their first or second role into a growth organization, a growth startup organization?
I think a lot of it is understanding you're going to make mistakes and you're going to have these moments with a crisis of confidence. And at the end of the day, the leader has to, you need to have conviction on the overall direction that you're going, but know it's going to be a zigzag. I know that every other leader has that same imposter syndrome, or it is a very common sickness that we all suffer from, that most of us suffer from, and that you push through. And to the extent you can have conviction on the direction, the North Star, people appreciate that. And that's very helpful for your team from a cultural perspective, a technical architecture perspective, like understand that North Star and then know your team is going to sort of zigzag on the way. And some of those zigs are going to hurt. You're going to invest 3 months in a project that you thought was going to be this wonderful architecture. And then you're going to realize it's way too complicated and that time is down the drain and you got to do something simpler that maybe won't scale as well. That's going to happen. And it's going to, you know, your CEO is going to say, why did you waste 90 days, an entire quarter of time? And, the answer is we didn't know until we got into it. And that's going to hurt sometimes, but it's a learning experience and every company and every project is different and you push through and you'll get there.
I think that's a fantastic tip. That's wonderful. Zach, how can people get hold of your book? How can they find because there's an audio book as well. You've just been telling me earlier on, how can they get hold of the book and actually find out about that?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. So it's called the Startup CTO's Handbook. You can find it on GitHub under Startup CTO Handbook, as well as Amazon, available around the world in paperback and Audible for those who like the audio version.
Fantastic. And how can people get hold of you, Zach, if they want to get in touch with you?
StartupCTOCoach.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm Zach Goldberg.
Excellent. So is coaching something that you're actively doing as well, then, coaching other CTOs?
Yes, sir. I work with people generally on a weekly basis doing, sort of exactly this conversation, building high performing engineering teams, helping people be the best leaders that they can.
That's music to me. I've one of the things I've been finding here in Europe is that there isn't that many people who sort of think, oh, that the CTO should have a coach. And I come across so many CEOs who have a coach and, as somebody who goes in and tries to convince CTOs that they should have a coach, the first reaction is just almost looking behind them, looking for the person I'm actually talking to. What, me, coach? Is that something you encounter as well? I mean, I was just asking out of curiosity here because I'm constantly trying to persuade people that CTO coaching is a really good and valuable thing.
I think the people who benefit most from coaching have, A, they're coachable to begin with. They understand, they have a sense of humility, and they know where their gaps are, or they know that there are gaps. A lot of leaders are very competent, which, you know, power to them. And I'll also acknowledge most of the coaching is not about teaching people technology. Right? There's this assumption you're the CTO and all you do is technology, and therefore you got the role because you're already good at technology. And that's true. You are very good at technology. You have that role. But the reality is engineering leadership, engineering is half the title. Leadership is the other half the title. And that's not something you learn in engineering school. And so that's what the coaching is really about, is all the leadership things, which is an enormous part of the job, if not a larger part of the job. And so the folks who recognize that the leadership part is a skill that can be learned over time, that there are mistakes that are avoidable, that you can get past, those folks tend to benefit well from coaching. And you know, at that point, it's just finding a great match.
That's absolutely wonderful to hear that. And to hear somebody else say something that I repeat week in, week out to all sorts of other people. Zach, it's been absolutely fantastic speaking to you. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Adam. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So for the listeners, do keep listening and make sure you go onto the website to find out how you can join the CTO Playbook community and for some of the access to the past playbooks that are all on there available as well. Thanks so much and keep leading with impact. Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.